Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here back at the club. And let's have a chance to learn a little bit about where we come from, who we are as a people, as the Exodus story really is our foundation in the superhero world, which I think some of these people were around when comic books were first getting started. In the superhero world, origin stories are all the rage, and so this is our origin story. This is where the Jewish people come from. We started out, and we became a people in Egypt. And so when we look at our origin story, there's a question we need to ask. I'll take you back to when I was a student in Yeshiva University, and it was during finals time. And during finals, there's no regularly scheduled Torah classes, even though ordinarily we have a dual curriculum where we spend time studying Torah and studying secular studies. But during finals, you got to spend more time focusing, and so there were no Torah classes at the time. And instead, I was just reading through the Parsha. I was reading through the Torah portion of the week. It happened to be this week's Torah portion. And I noticed something that was very troubling. So troubling, in fact, that I spent much longer than I should have looking at the Torah portion and much less time studying, and my grades were definitely affected. So let's understand that question. This question that bothered me so much those many years ago, I want to share with you today, because I've thought about it basically every year since. The question is as follows. If we think about the iconic moments in TV and movie history, one of the most iconic moments is in Star Wars, where people say that Darth Vader reveals to Luke Skywalker that he's his father. And people have shared, "Luke, I am your father." There's one problem with that iconic moment. It never happened. At no point in any of the movies does Darth Vader say that line, "Luke, I am your father." And what's more disturbing is that if we look at maybe amongst the most famous movies of our history, of our origin story, we look at Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments, what's the line? "Let my people go." We've got songs about it, and we're always talking about how Moses demanded from Pharaoh, "Let my people go." Does that sound about right? Except again, there's one problem. It never happened. At no point in time does Moses demand that Pharaoh free the slaves. At no point in time does Moses demand that Pharaoh let us go to the promised land. Instead, what does he ask? He says, "Pharaoh, do me a favor. Give us a long weekend. We want the Jewish people to leave Egypt for just 3 days. Not forever. We're not going to Israel. Just 3 days." And this isn't just a Moses messing up the instruction. If we look at the instruction that God gives Moses in their initial meeting, back in last week's Parsha, at the burning bush, what does God tell him? "You're going to Israel." If we look in Exodus 3:8, it's very, very clear. That "V'arei v'hatzilom yam Mitzrayim," I plan on saving the Jewish people from Egypt. "U'lahalozo min ha'aretz ahi el eretz tovar rakava." I'm going to take them out of this terrible place, Egypt, and bring them to a wonderful place. What's that wonderful place? El eretz zavat chalav u'divash. This place flowing with milk and honey. But what place flowing with milk and honey? None other than the place, the residence of Hakhnani, Hachiti, Hamori, Hapriti, Hachivi, Hayibusi. Listed 7 nations that live in this place. It could not be clearer where they're going. Where are they going? They're going to Israel. So Moses is told that, "I want you to take the Jewish people out of Egypt and bring them to Israel." And yet, just 10 psukim later, 10 verses later, God gives him the exact script that he's supposed to share with Pharaoh. What's he supposed to tell Pharaoh? Plain and simply, "Uvasa el paro b'zikne Yisrael," Pasuk 18, "el melech Mitzrayim," go to Paro and tell him, "Hashem lokei ha'ivrim," God of the Hebrews, "nikra elenu," he calls out to us, and says, "Ve'ata," and now, "nelech anan derech shloshes yamim," let us travel 3 days into the desert. What's this 3 days coming from? You don't want to go for 3 days. You want to go all the way to Israel. Why is Pharaoh being told that they're only going to leave for 3 days when they intend to leave forever? What's so disturbing about this is that this is our origin. the foundation of the Jewish people begins with a fallacy, with a lie. This little 3-day bookwink that Moses and Aaron have going on is totally inaccurate. They have no intention of just traveling to the desert for 3 days. They intend to go all the way to Israel. And that's what we're going to try and understand today. That's what we're going to try and figure out. What in the world is going on with this question? How could we ask Pharaoh something that we don't intend to fulfill? It would seem that Pharaoh is going to let us go for 3 days, and we're going to run, and eventually Pharaoh's going to say, oh no, the Jewish people lied to me, and now our whole beginning is built on a lie. Let's try and figure it out. I want to introduce you to someone named the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi was one of the famed Rosh Yeshiva of the Vilna Yeshiva. He was one of the biggest rabbis in Lithuania. He lived during the 19th century, and he's the namesake of what in Yeshiva University world we call the Rav. Huh? So he was in Lithuania, he was in the city of Vilna. And they had a big yeshiva there. Are you from Lithuania?
Where is the big yeshiva?
The big yeshiva was in the city of Vilna, that's why they called it the Vilna Yeshiva. You familiar with Vilna?
Huh?
Are you familiar with Vilna?
I'm from Poland.
Ah, okay. You're right there. You could have gone to visit. So that yeshiva unfortunately closed in the beginning of the 1900s. So it wasn't around that long. Maybe you couldn't have actually visited. But when it was standing, the Vilna Yeshiva was the biggest yeshiva in the world. It was actually kind of the forerunner to what the modern yeshiva experience looks like. And so, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, who's the namesake of whom we call Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, the Rav, who was the leader of the Yeshiva University and the teacher of most of the rabbis that we've interacted with for the past century. And so Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik wrote a sefer called the Beis Halevi. It's called the House of the Levi. He was from the tribe of Levi. And he taught us, he tried to figure out what's going on in this situation. Now we'll explain for a moment why the Beis Halevi. He was a Talmudist. He studied intricate Torah law. He did. Why was he worried about the Parsha? Why is he reading the Parsha and telling us things about the Parsha? So what's interesting is that the Beis Halevi comes from this dynasty. He really started the dynasty of brisk learning. And the specifics of brisk learning are not important for the moment, but they didn't ascribe to this idea of learning musar, or chasidu. They didn't spend time learning character developing things, whether from a more Kabbalistic perspective or from like a social-emotional perspective. And so chasidu and musar were not involved in brisk learning. But if you're a brisker and you don't spend time learning books that are going to teach you how to be a mensch, how do you make sure that your students are a mensch? How do you make sure your kids are a mensch, your children, your grandchildren? How do you make sure that they're menschlich, that they have menschlichkeit, if you don't spend time teaching it to them? So what do they basically do? Oh. So you got to lead by example, for sure. And we actually have incredible stories about the briskers and their amazing chesed, their amazing sensitivity and thoughtfulness. I'll share one story, not from the Beis Halevi himself, from his son, Rafayim Brisker. Rafayim Brisker was the son of the Beis Halevi. He was amongst the greatest minds that we've had in a long time. His writing is so clear and so sharp and so fascinating. He was also a tremendous Baal Chesed. He gave so much, he gave it himself. He was incredible. And not just that he gave so much in terms of quantity, but the quality and the care that he showed was beyond. We'll share one story about it. A woman came to Rafayim Brisker shortly before Pesach and said, Rebbe, can I use milk for the arbakozos, the 4 cups of traditionally wine that we drink on the Seder night, can I use milk instead? And so Rafayim Brisker thought for a moment, and he said, better to use wine, and here's the money for it. And he gave her the money to buy the wine that she would need in order to have it on the Seder night. Oh, that's so nice, that's so thoughtful. Except someone else in the house, maybe his wife, maybe one of his students, says, Rebbe, it looks like you gave a lot more than just the requisite sum for wine. You didn't just give her enough money for 4 cups. You gave her enough for like a whole Seder meal. Why'd you give her so much money? Your kind Brisker said, you gotta think for a moment. She's asking if she can have milk for the four cups. If she's having milk, that means that she's not planning on having meat as well. She probably doesn't have enough food for a real Suda, for a real festive Seder meal. So I gave her enough money to cover the entire thing, not just for that milk. And so there's a modeling for sure that we saw with the Briskers of tremendous chesed, but it goes deeper. Because not everyone was able to watch Rav Chaim Brisker and Beis HaLevi all the time, but what could you do? They used to give shiur on the Parsha. They would teach about the Parsha, similar to what we're doing right here, right now. And when they learned the Parsha, they weren't really trying to examine the Parsha, they were trying to examine the deeper messages therein. And through Parsha, you learned to be a mensch. You learn character development. And so the Beis HaLevi in our Parsha is looking at this story and not saying, what happened? Historically, what took place? The Beis HaLevi is trying to understand, how can we appreciate, how can we understand what's going on here for our purposes, for a personal development standpoint? Still, the explanation he provides does align historically. And he says as follows. Imagine if I came up to you and said, hi, can I please borrow a pencil? Now, if you had a pencil, would you give it to me? Yeah, no big deal. It's not such a big ask. If I came up to you and said, hi, can I move into your house? You might not say yes so quickly. That's fair. So if I make a big request from you, you might not say yes. If I make a small request, you might actually be able to acquiesce to say yes. There have to be a big reason for you to say no if you had a whole bag of pencils that you wouldn't just lend me one or even give me one if you had so many. Explains the Beis HaLevi that for Paro to let the Jewish people leave forever, to lose all of his slaves, that's a big ask. That's a very big request, and it's understandable that Paro would not say yes. He doesn't want to lose all of his free labor. But what could he do? What is realistic? What's feasible? It's similar, if you will, to asking for a pencil. Hey, Paro, would it be possible to give the slaves a long weekend? You know, Martin Luther King Day is coming up. They want to go on vacation. Airbnb is very cheap these days. They can get flights. Let's let them go on a quick little vacation to the desert. Just 3 days. And done, they'll come back. They'll continue to work. But at least they had a vacation. Now, if you have free labor for 365 days a year, and you lose out on that free labor for just 3 days a year, is it such a big ask? Is it so bad and so difficult? No. And so why couldn't Paro just say yes to a small request? Just 3 days. And explains the Beis HaLevi what occurs historically, what God was intending in this 3-day request was not to obfuscate what was going on, not to try and trick Paro, but to give Paro an opportunity to say yes a little bit. Just a light little request, just a couple days. Just 3 days. Not a couple, a few. A couple means two. A few might mean three, but a couple always only means two. That's what a couple means. Sometimes people use it differently, and they are incorrect. And so, when Paro says no to a small little 3-day request, what does that really indicate? And this is where the Beis HaLevi jumps in. What's that really showing us? That this slavery was not about the labor. Paro wasn't enslaving the Jewish people for monetary gain, because there would have been minimal monetary loss with a long weekend. What was really motivating Paro? It was an ideological, a theological campaign. Paro held himself and declared himself to be a god. And what are Moshe and Aaron asking? Let the Jewish people go on vacation for 3 days. Jews don't vacation and sit on the beach the whole time. When Jews go on vacation, it means that they have more time to pray. It means they have more time to learn Torah. What are we going to do in the desert? We're going to offer sacrifices to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Moshe and Aaron are saying, not just give us a vacation for 3 days, but give us the opportunity to worship our God, not you, Paro, someone else, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We want to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu for 3 days. And so for Paro, it's no longer a light little task. It's not a small monetary request. This is a theological request, because this request is asking Paro to say that that maybe I'm not the only power in Egypt. Maybe there's someone else, something else, that's much bigger and much more powerful, that's worthy of being worshipped. And to that, power can't say yes. Power refuses, even such a small request as 3 days. And that's a beautiful thought from a Joseph Dov Halevi celebration of the 19th century. But his great-grandson, Rabbi Joseph, who's named after his great-grandfather, takes it even further. Because he says, maybe, the intention was not necessarily to go to Israel right now. Maybe in the year 2448, there was no plan to go to Israel. Moshe was told the long-term, the historic plan that God wanted the Jewish people to enter into Israel. But in this circumstance, they were planning on coming back. It was not a hoodwink. It was not a lie. They really, really were planning on coming back to Egypt. So in that case, what does 3 days accomplish? Explain to Rabbi Salavage so beautifully. I learned this from Rabbi Ari Kahn. His book, Emanations, talks about it, for those interested. Explain to Rabbi Salavage that the plan was that we were going to take these slaves out of their servitude, out of Egypt, bring them to the desert for a Shabbaton, the biggest, best Shabbaton you've ever been to. And there would be amazing speakers and amazing food and lights and sound and a kumtet that goes until 3:30 in the morning. They would be so excited, so riled up with enthusiasm for Torah, for mitzvot, for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that when the Jews came back to Egypt, they would be different people. Would they still be working in free labor? Yes. But they would also be inspired. They would also be enthusiastic about living a life of godliness. And so the Jews would have looked different upon their return, and eventually, suggests Rabbi Salavage, the Egyptians also would have looked different. That if you've got an entire Jewish people, between 2 and 3 million people, all excited about Torah mitzvot, and they're walking around saying Baruch Hashem, and they're having Shabbos and Kabbalah Shabbos and Shabbos Sudos, and they're taking things seriously. Napoleon, when he found out about Tisha B'Av, said, "What temple are the Jewish people mourning?" And they said, "Oh, that temple that was destroyed, 1700 years ago, 1600 years ago." Napoleon said, "Any people with history and a perspective that far back, they're going to last. They're going to sustain." So yes, even a Tisha B'Av, if by the Jews observing our customs and our lifestyle, we would make an impact on the local Egyptians. And after a while, maybe not 5 years, probably not 5 years, maybe not 10, maybe 50 or 100 or 200, maybe 400. Maybe after 190 years, the Jewish people would have made such an impact in Egypt that Egypt would have become monotheistic as well. Egypt would have abandoned worshipping the Nile and worshipping Pharaoh, and they would start worshipping HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if we think about this for a moment, what was the world superpower at the time? Egypt. And so if the world superpower has now become Prum, has now become Orthodox, has now become engaged in Torah mitzvot and monotheistic, then is it possible that monotheism would have spread not just in Egypt, but beyond? That all the people that were coming to this superpower, they're coming for the UN meetings, and they're coming for the dignitaries, and they're coming because we have the best blue jeans. All the reasons why people come. And they're exposed to Torah and Mitzvot? Maybe it would have caught on. And all of a sudden, monotheism would have spread, not just amongst the Jewish people, but throughout the entire world. Now this is a cool idea. It's something I feel very strongly about and very passionately about. So let's see if we can extend it a tiny bit further before we have to wrap up. I'd like to suggest that the Jewish people as an entity, as a unit, and are bidyevid, are after the fact, are not ideal. God does not want Jews to exist. What do I mean? It's a pretty strong statement for a rabbi, as we're saying. I think that when God created the world, it's fair to say that when God created the world, there was no intention of having Jews. He didn't want to have Jews. What did God want? He wanted every person in the whole world to recognize him, for everyone to be an Anonymous. Now, it wasn't that many people, it was just Adam and Eve. But Adam and Eve messed up. And so now, they didn't all recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the fullest extent possible, and so God says, all right, that didn't work out. And now with his children, with their children, after 10 generations, and Noah is living in the world, people are acting very non-godly. They've abandoned monotheism entirely. They're worshiping idols. They're kind of worshiping themselves. And so God says, let's try again. Wipes out the world with a flood and starts all over with a new family. What's that new family? Noah and his children. And God's like, this is going to be it. This is going to be a family built on monotheism. But, again, 10 generations later, it hasn't worked out. It's not going well. And so God effectively gives up and says, I'm not going to try and spread monotheism to every human being in this manner. Instead, I'm just going to have one family, Abraham and Sarah, and they're going to spread monotheism to people around them, and at the very least, to their children. And so sure enough, the Jewish people are born. But the Jewish people are born after two failed attempts. Perhaps we can suggest that God didn't give up with Abraham and Sarah. Maybe God tried to make a slightly longer plan. And it wasn't going to be monotheism through these parents and pass it on to their children and their children. But they were going to create monotheism for the Jewish people. And in Egypt, they were going to spread it to the whole world. And this was God's last attempt at a monotheistic world. But unfortunately, Paro couldn't save us. Paro just wasn't willing to acquiesce to a small, three-day request. For ultimately, the goal and our job in this world is to be that Or Lagoyim, to be that light, to spread monotheism, to spread godliness, to spread morality, thoughtfulness. We could go on a list of all the adjectives that unfortunately today have seemingly fallen apart. But we could spread that. We could spread Menschlichkeit to the world. And maybe, just by embodying that, the goal of those 3 days for the Jewish people was not that they would learn to become Kiruv workers. They weren't going to specifically go for classes on how to convert their Egyptian neighbors. They were just going to be personally inspired, and that would have spread on its own. And maybe if we also are personally inspired, personally engaged, we come and we want to learn Torah on a Wednesday afternoon, maybe that will spread, even if I'm not telling anyone or forcing anyone to do something. And I think it's so beautifully described in a story that I heard when I was in camp. I must have been like 12 years old, from Rabbi David Teller. I love this story. One day, there's a rabbi in Texas, and he gets a knock on his door, and a cowboy comes in with the whole getup. He's got the jeans and the boots and the hat and the thing around the neck, I'm forgetting what it's called. You know what I mean. Not just a handkerchief, the cowboy tie. All right, another tie. And this cowboy says, Rabbi, I'm not going to do the voice, I'm not good at accents. He says, Rabbi, I'd like to donate $5 million to your synagogue. $5 million? That's so generous, that's so nice, but why are you donating $5 million to my synagogue? And he says, well, it's not just your synagogue. I want you to build up your synagogue, and I want you to build a school. And I want to make sure that lots of Jewish children go to that school. And I'm going to send my children to that school. So the rabbi's got to know, what happened in this cowboy's life that he feels so strongly about sending his children to a Jewish school? He says, well, let me tell you. My family and I were on a trip, and we traveled all over the world. Thank God, I'm a very successful businessman. He told me to say thank God. And so people convinced us that we should go visit Israel. So we went to visit Israel, and sure enough, we're at the Wailing Wall, as we know, the Western Wall, the Kotel. And it's Friday night, and everyone tells us you should be at the Kotel on Friday night, the Wailing Wall Friday night. And we're there, and there's lots of activity, and there's lots of singing and there's dancing. But the thing that struck me most was not the beautiful singing and dancing going on, but there was one man standing at the corner. He was standing at the corner of the wall, and I could see that there were a lot of people whose lips were moving, a lot of people with books open, but that man wasn't just praying. That man was talking to God. I could see, I could feel it. He was talking to God. And I decided in that moment that I want my children to be able to talk to God. Because I picked up the prayer right, and I didn't feel it. I didn't feel like I was talking to God, even though he was, but my children can. So I'm going to donate money. I'm going to make sure that we build a school so that my children can talk to God one day. And so sure enough, the rabbi takes that money, and he builds up the shul, and he builds up the school, and the Jewish community in Texas is on the rise. And there are tons of Jewish children learning how to pray, learning Torah. And it's all in this cowboy's schus, all in this cowboy's merit. And sure enough, when the cowboy gets to Shemayim, he gets to his final judgment after 120 years, we can imagine what will happen. There'll be a scale of some sort, and you know, all of his good deeds in his life are going to be put on one side, all of the things that could have been better will be on the other, and maybe they'll weigh out, maybe not, but then all of the donations, all of the effort from his charitable donation, that $5 million, that's going to be added to the right side. To the right side of his scale, that's going to be added to the positive side, and he will have a positive judgment at the end of his life. Beautiful story. But let's think for a moment, not about the cowboy, not about the rabbi, not about anyone in Texas. Let's think about the Yerushalmi Yid, the Jew, davening in the corner of the Kotel. He probably didn't know anyone was looking at him. He probably had no clue that his Friday night davening made an impact on anyone. That night, he probably got home, and he had Shabbat Suda with his family, and he got up and went to davening the next day, and continued to live his life, completely unaware that he had made such a profound impact. And so at the end of his life, when he gets to Shemayim, he gets to the heavens, and there's a grand judgment happening, and they weigh his negative activities, and God willing, they're not so much. And it's positive, and there's a lot of positive. And he's doing well. He lived a spiritual life. He's got a lot more positive than negative. But as they're ready to wrap up, they're going to close the books, and oh, he's got a nice positive judgment. They hear from the corner, wait! We've got a couple more things. As an angel comes running by, and is holding a little cowboy. Puts the cowboy on the scale a little bit more. Wait! Now the cowboy's family comes in. And the angel puts it on the cowboy's family. Wait! Now the rabbi comes in, and the built-up shul comes in, and the angel puts it down. And then a school comes in, and there are three angels carrying it, because it's big, it's heavy, there's tons of merit there, tons of skills. And they put it down on a scale, on the positive side. And finally, there are eight angels are trying to carry something, it's huge. And eventually, they see, oh my gosh, those angels are carrying the entire state of Texas. The squeals of all Texas go for this Yerushalmi Yid. And what does this Yerushalmi Yid, what does this Israeli Jew say? I'm not in Texas. What's Texas? I don't know what Texas is. I lived in Yerushalayim my whole life. And he doesn't even know that he made such an impact. But at the end of his life, all of these squeals, far outweighing anything he even did personally, all because of something he did, just part of his normal life. A regular Friday night for him was an extraordinary experience for someone else. And so if we think that maybe it's hard to imagine that just a three-day inspiration could make such an impact on the land of Egypt and eventually the whole world, think about Texas. Think about a regular Jew davening on Friday night. Because you can make that impact. It's possible without spreading Torah to everyone, without doing lots of things, just being who you are, that can also spread godliness, that can also spread light Torah. That can also be meaningful. That can eventually complete God's plan for the entire world. Thank you so much for learning everything today. I look forward to coming back next time.
Have a wonderful day.